This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
So we're here at the end of the Trial Lawyers University Conference and been recording all week. Robert's been out here from Law Pods producing all of our shows, flew out here with the equipment. We thank you so much for doing that. It's been great recording live and I just really appreciate it.
No, fellas, I can't tell you what an absolute pleasure it's been to come here and do this for you. We've been working together for a while on your show. We've had some conversations over Zoom, but this is the first time to see you both in person, and it was every bit as good as I hoped it would be. So thanks so much for letting me be involved in your podcast, and this kind of lets me live my dream too. So thanks.
No, you were fantastic, and you know what? Everything is fully professional. You've been amazing to work with, and you do such a great job. So In addition to being a good person, so thank you.
Thanks so much.
And a recovering lawyer.
Yeah, I did my time.
Thanks. Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, we are live in person, side by side, not actually technically coast to coast anymore.
It's so amazing. It's so great to be out in LA, the beautiful weather and looking out over at the marina and the taco bar and the ping pong tables with the vendor stations and speeches. It's just great.
So at the PSBR Trial College where we are, there's about almost 400 lawyers here. All learning, and they got to learn from you today. What did you teach about?
So we did a breakout room in medical malpractice, which was super great. It was capped, I think, at 8 students, and we ended up having more like 10 or 11. So we had some people just kind of randomly wandering into the room, which I thought was cool. The title of my breakout room was Malpractice Cases from Intake to Trial. So that was a little bit overly ambitious, even for a 3 to 4 hour breakout session, because that basically means everything. We pretty much focused on the trial. So I did an opening in a trial. I did a closing from another trial. And then we worked on everybody's individual cases. And I think people really got some value out of that and made their cases better. So we got great feedback, and I'd love to do it again. It was really fun.
Oh, that's awesome. They're so lucky to actually learn from you on MedMal cases. I mean, that's something that they're going to take away and probably do a whole lot better for their clients. So congrats on that.
I hope so. So you're speaking in about an hour or an hour and a half. What are you talking about?
I'm going to talk about voir dire and particularly what I did on the two cases in Vegas a few months ago. So kind of touch on some points and hopefully get some little techniques that everybody can take away and possibly implement in their own cases. So my goal is little bite-sized pieces. I'm not trying to teach the whole thing all at once, but hopefully there'll be a few little nuggets.
Well, I'll be there. We all report back tomorrow on what I learned. How about
awesome.
That?
Awesome. I love it. I love it. So here's the other great thing. Now that we're here, we've got a captive group of amazing trial lawyers, and one of them with us right now, Dan Kramer. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great. On the couch, in person. I love it.
It is great. So Dan, a couple of things we want to talk about, but one is you actually got to teach a breakout session here today as well. But before we even get into that, president of the LA TLC, you're on the executive committee for the LA chapter of ABOTA, you're a leader in CALA, you're a well-established trial lawyer with your own law firm and practice, and which is flourishing and growing. Tell us how you got from point A to Z.
Oh, man. Well, I went to Southwestern Law School. I thought I was going to be doing contract work, like M&A stuff, took tax classes. Last thing I want to do was litigate. And then my very first job out of law school was actually with an insurance defense firm, Gilbert Kelly. And I was sitting at some event with the managing partner having a beer, and we were just hit it off. And he's like, you know what, man? He's like, I really think you'd like to get in front of 12 citizens and tell a story and represent a client. He's like, I really see you wanting to do that. I think you'd flourish in that. Sure enough, I started doing defense work, tried my first case like 10 months out of law school, and just was hooked. Absolutely loved it. Loved trying cases. After 4 years on the defense side, you know, it just kind of started to get a little hollow. You get a defense verdict, you save insurance company a few $100,000, like business as usual. Remember, there's one case, it was a rear end crash. We defensed a teacher on a rear end crash, and she like went to the hospital and told a defense verdict. And I'm feeling good about it, but my mom was like, is that really right? You know, I mean, she didn't have the best counsel on the other side. You know, I don't think he really did much PI, and we just had better experts and all that. And I remember my mom specifically said, you know, do you really feel like that's justice that was served there? And then after a while, you know, I kind of just started to see it. And I just really just the passion that I had initially just being a trial lawyer was great, but I kind of lost what I was doing. What was I really doing moving the ball forward for people? And so about 10 years ago, launched my firm with two other partners and just did all plaintiffs work. Absolutely fell in love with it. I mean, there's nothing better, as you guys know very well, just representing the client and their need, you know, their darkest hour, and then going to trial and, you know, holding corporations accountable. But during that time, I just really believed in getting involved and really getting involved in the community, helping out younger lawyers, because that's how I learned from guys like you, honestly, Raul. And you guys were such good mentors that, you know, I got to give it back. So just want to get involved in organizations. And that's kind of what led to, you know, being a leader in these different organizations.
What's going on with the Trial Lawyers College these days?
You know, how much time do you have?
We'll start with the Cliff Notes. How about that?
Yeah, I mean, I went in 2015 when it was still all cohesive, a big happy family, and haven't really been too involved since, but I know they got their factions. I know there's issues there, but I've honestly stayed out of it.
Well, that's the Cliff Notes version.
All right. Yeah, all right. Maybe the slightly more dramatic version of that.
Well, did you love going there?
Yeah. I mean, it was a different experience than I thought it was going to be, but I mean, some of my closest friends, you know, Olivia Taliu was in my class, Keith Bruno, Angela Bruno, bunch of great people that I got really close with, and they're doing great monster verdicts, and really learned how to tell a client's story and really get into what's going on with them, how to really set the scene, frame a case, and kind of, you know, just really put yourself in their shoes and more empathetic. My wife wishes I go once a year, because so when I came back, I was just so nice and kind and sweet and, you know, really compassionate. And I guess I've hardened since then, but I may need to go back for a refresher course.
You know, the barrier for me going was always my family and my wife, because at one point they required like a 3-week commitment. Or is that still the case?
Yeah.
So I am very interested in your topic of opening statements that I know you presented on led a breakout group in this morning, right?
Is that yesterday?
Oh, yesterday. Okay. What's the thinking about openings now? What's your thinking about them?
First off, this is my first time ever leading a breakout group, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, as we were talking a little bit before, it is eye-opening to be able to lead it and really analyze people's cases and take a case. You just really get deep into a case in 10 minutes and really just try to retell the story, help them retell the story. So what we did is we did opening statement structure. I love structure, period. I just really think it helps. Anyone can apply it, can use it, you know, and I just like, it's how you plug it in. I used to be very married to the David Ball opening, and I still love it. I think it's very effective. I do a slight derivative of it that I kind of learned from Trojan Horse back with Ambrose back 7 years ago, where especially if you have like a corporation, I like to do a short intro where I don't really name names, but I say, you know, for example, on an employment case I did, a man worked for a company for 6 years. That man was injured on the job. 30 days later, he was fired. This is the story of that man. And then I will go into a good versus bad. So good corporations, you know, they, when someone is injured on the job, they try to help and make sure that they can, the employee can get better. They hold their job for them. They really work with them. They sit down, have a good conversation so that they can keep them employed, because they know it's good for the employee. It's good for the company to treat employees like that. And it's good for the community to keep people employed, just, you know, if they're disabled, and help work with them. But some companies say, hey, it's all about the bottom line. If someone's hurt, they got to figure it out themselves. We're a for-profit business. We have nothing to do with it. And you kind of want to match the bad fact, the generic bad, with exactly what the defendant did in your case on the betrayal. I think it obviously works really well with corporate. When you have corporate clients, I struggle when it's just a, you know, a mom defendant, for example. I don't think it really works. But so we did that for the structure. So we had two meetings before this conference, actually, with, so we could learn their cases. We had about 8 people, but about 15 to 20 actually came in, set in. And so we had them do 2 different segments of their opening. It was either establishing the rule, and we worked that, and then really how to tell the story, you know, and how to really tell a compelling story. And I think the biggest thing that we worked with, and where the students got a lot better, was basically, instead of using names and dates, you know, because I think a lot of lawyers, they start their story part of the opening and they say, you know, it's April 15th, 2020. John Doe is driving next to Mary Smith. And it's just like, because when jurors hear dates and names, they're like, oh, I have to remember that. I have to remember that. And then they're kind of losing the story part. So we really just took all that out, because they all naturally just went there as a default. It's like, no one cares about the date yet. Like, you really don't. You just say, you know, it is, and you can say a date. And then wherever you're starting your timeline, 3 months later, and then 6 months later, and 9 months later. So it's kind of like, it's an easier timeline to follow. And not even really using names if you don't have to, like driver, passenger, especially if it's a driver who's driving for a corporation. Like, there's no need to really say the driver's name early on. So it's just a different way to tell the active story, so the jury can focus on that and not memorizing. So we did that, and we really flipped people's stories, and it was really good. They really got into the scene, you know, a lot of trial lawyers, college stuff, and then doing a lot of Ambrose, you know, dialogue. And then we kind of did some portions of dismantling the defenses. And Connell Doyle and I actually had a good debate on the best way to do that in opening, whether you go kind of David Ball, things we had to look into, or this is what the defense is going to say. I'm curious what you do in your opening when you're talking about the defenses or want to confront them and flip it.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions, and then I'll answer that one. But have you heard from jurors after your trials that your organization of your opening statement was very helpful, or any feedback on that?
Yeah, 100%. To me, opening is one of the most important, if not the most important part of trial, because you can really destroy the defense's case and really lay out your case all in one. But yes, I have heard from jurors saying they really had such a good grasp from the visuals that we were using in opening, and we fight like hell to get visuals and play depo clips in opening to really just lay out the whole case, obviously. But yeah, we get a lot of feedback on that, and it really helps the jury for the roadmap.
Yeah. I think one of the goals, at least whenever I try to frame my opening statement, when I get to the defense contentions, my whole goal is that when I say what it is, the jury already should know what the answer, or at least what my position is on it, because of how I've laid everything out. And so as I'm working through at least how I'm framing the opening statement for whatever case it is, when I get to that point, I want that jury to already be like, I already know what the answer is. You've already told us what it is, or I've already learned it and been taught that that's ridiculous because of X, Y, and Z.
So do you present it as a question, like the kind of what we had to look into, or
no,
do you say these are defense contentions?
There you go. You'll hear from the defense, or I expect the defense will argue the following. First, yeah, this, and then we'll talk about some of the evidence, and then second, and then third, and then try to, yeah, take the wind out of their sails. But I want to address it head on so that when they come up and say exactly that, they're in a hard spot.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And you have to address all of them. I mean,
yeah,
truly, because if you leave one out, they're going to come up. That's the first thing they're going to
totally
say if it's an effective defense attorney. Oh, they forgot to mention this.
You know, this came up in my breakout group this morning because there are a couple questions about opening and also the defenses. And somebody asked the very question that you just asked about whether we use the David Vall things we had to look into before we came to court. I never really loved that formulation of it. What I've moved to is simply, this case has been going on a long time and we know what they're going to say. So let me just tell you right now and we can talk about it. And one thing I've learned over time is I don't want to spend much time on it, because I felt like early in my career, I felt very defensive about all the defenses and felt the need to dismantle them all in the opening. But what I realized is people think that the things you spend time talking about are important. So if you glorify them by spending too much time on them, you're, you know, raising their importance, even if what you're saying is why they're wrong. So I try to do like a very terse, pithy, like just one or two sentence way to dismiss it as kind of ridiculous. And then I let them know I'll come back to it and we'll show them more later, but I don't want to spend inordinate amount of time on it.
100% agree with that. And a lot of times I think we can argue better than the defense can. So sometimes when we're doing the defenses, we're saying it better than they would anyway, and more articulate. And it's like, well, you might convince some jurors because of the way you're presenting it. And I agree. I think I just gave a talk on what to do with sub rosa and social media impeachment stuff at trial. And the big point was you really do minimize it. Don't make it a focus, even though you're scared, really scared of it. You know, we're all scared of getting hit with a sub rosa, but just the jury's watching you. Even when you're sitting on the counsel table, just don't make a big deal. Like twirl your pen, or, you know, just don't react to it. And then when you come up, it's just, you know, you own it, but you move on. I 100% agree. Not putting a flashlight on all the defenses.
So what do you do after you do the good and bad, and then you do the, you tell the story of the case in using fairly generic terminology without specific dates and names?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the case. But usually I'll set, it depends on how far back I have to go. For example, I tried a slip and fall case against LAX, and it was about the issue was really some other passenger had spilled coffee all over the floor. Clearly not LAX's fault, but when we tested the flooring, it was well below the coefficient of friction. It was like the standard should be 0.5 and above for slip resistant tile. Both experts found it to be 0.18. So it's like ridiculous tile to be in a busy restroom where millions of people go through a year. So we had to go back way back to like 10 years before and start the story there, and had to basically start it when the restroom was being remodeled. And the decisions that came into play with the head of construction for LAX and talking to the workers and being like, which tile should we use? And they're making that decision. And they're like, well, this tile seems fine. It's cheaper. Well, did we test it? Did we make sure it's safe? Oh, it's we just eyeball it. Looks fine to me. Put it in. So I had to start a story there before I even get to what happened. And then I kind of presented it as a woman spills coffee. Half hour goes by. Then I did the perspective of the janitors who didn't see it for like an hour and a half. And she went and had her break. So I did that whole scene. And then a woman gets off a plane, walks in the restroom, her foot hits the liquid in the floor and she lands on her back. And that woman, as a result, had to have 3 back surgeries, is going to be in permanent pain the rest of her life, because LAX chose to use slippery tile when they knew it should have been slip resistant. So I say that woman is, you know, Lori Triplett. And then I say her name, not until, like, don't even mention her name until the very end of my story, and just give a quick synopsis of the, how bad it is. But yeah, that's kind of, it really depends. You know, it depends on when did the bad act start? It's a company policy stuff. You go way back to, you know, set the scenes of the boardroom. I'm big on like having like 2 or 3 scenes in your opening statement story.
Can you tell us about these scenes? I'm curious about that. You act them out sort of, or like?
Well, a little bit. I mean, just one case we were working on yesterday with a guy, it was a fight, you know? And so we had to decide where to start the fight. And I think the initial inclination was to give the whole background of what was going on, but you really didn't need that. And so what we did is we kind of created what character do we want to have watching the fight? Do you want to tell the story from someone in the fight? And we kind of came up with the idea of like, imagine someone is walking their dog at 2 a.m. and they're standing there and they see the fight. So told it from the perspective of that bystander, just watching it, and set the scene that way and kind of have him. And I think when you, as an attorney, can put yourself there, the camera lens or that, whoever that person is. But I think a lot of times using a bystander can work, just like, you know, a neutral observer, just like in a movie, you know, where like where you see a scene that kind of starts where the action's already going on, can be very effective. So that kind of stuff. And then you could change people.
Can you give us like a short snippet of what that might sound like?
So, yeah. So, I don't want to talk about that case, but, so for the LAX one, it was, I started the scene with the decision. And then I said, you know, then I did the scene from the janitor, she, you know, her brakes over, she takes her 50 pound cart, moves pretty slowly, goes to the elevator goes up and then goes to one restroom. Meanwhile, in this restroom 206, there's, you know, hundreds of women going in and out, planes just unloaded, people are using the restroom, going, you know, in and out. In the handicap restroom, the trash can in the corner, it slowly starts to fill with trash, water bottles, and slowly starts to fill. The janitor, she's in the restroom 207, taking her time, cleaning restroom 207. The trash can in 206 keeps getting loaded with trash. Coffee spills in the handicap stall. The janitor goes downstairs, takes another 20-minute break. Trash is now overflowing. The coffee's sitting on the ground. The janitor is slowly going back upstairs. A woman gets off her flight, walks in the restroom, and then slips and falls. So just tell that story again. So kind of doing it from two different, I did it better in the real one, but, you know, just kind of doing it from different angles, like from the trash can perspective to the janitor's perspective. So kind of doing two scenes at the same time.
How are you moving in the courtroom when you're doing this?
Yeah, totally.
So you're like changing your position, or are you changing your tones?
Well, yeah. So I set wherever some part of the courtroom is going to be the restroom. And then kind of over here, you know, to my right would be like somewhere on the other end of the courtroom would be the janitor and have her doing her things. And I'd go back. And then throughout trial, I will kind of plant the restroom always there. So when I'm doing a direct of a witness, I'll do that same scene in that same place, my closing, you know, same scene, same place, so that I want the jury to just to imagine it and really see it in that same place at all times so that they have a total vision of it. And I think if I do it throughout trial, it'll have more of an impact.
You mentioned something about dialogue. Do you use dialogue, like try to reenact conversations or things like that?
Yeah.
How does that go?
Good. Like, again, I mean, this, since we're talking about the LAX case, I mean, when I did the tile, for example, you know, the decision. And so the head of construction, and they're redoing his bathroom, and he says to the worker, he says, you know, what kind of tile are we going to use? And so I'll give that directly to a juror. And, you know, the worker says, I think the rules say we're supposed to do slip-resistant tile. Do you think we should test it? The director, or basically the person in charge of construction, says, we'll just do the giggle test. We'll just eyeball it, because that's real testimony. So that's real testimony he gave me. The rules say they're supposed to use slip resistant. So I'll give the dialogue kind of like that and then make sure to give it to a juror directly.
Oh, that's great stuff. I like that. I can see how that would be pretty engaging compared to the dry way openings are often delivered.
Yeah. No, I mean, it took a lot of work to do. I mean, honestly, a lot of that is Trial Lawyers College. A lot of it is Ambrose. Just doing all these different, you know, there's no one right way to do it. And I think for younger lawyers, do as many of these things as you can and just pick up what works for you. You know, I mean, some stuff is really going to resonate with you. Other stuff is just like, that's not really me. But I think you have to give yourself the exposure and the opportunity to do all the different stuff. David Ball, Trial Lawyers College, Trojan Horse, you know, TLU. I mean, there's Cala, PTA was amazing for me. Anything and everything is good, I think, in terms of these conferences. And I don't think you should necessarily get married. It's not dogma. One way is not just the only way.
So when you've seen or been taught different types of strategies or techniques, can you give us an example of a couple that didn't really fit your style?
Yeah, I mean, the David Ball thing, I really do love all his stuff. And I mean, his The Damages Theory is one of the best books we've ever had in our side of the, you know, equation here. But the things we had to look into for some reason, and again, I don't want to get a lot of hate for this, but it wasn't true to for me. And so that's why I was having trouble, because to be honest, I mean, when I was going through the case, it's like, yeah, we looked into it. We looked into it because we knew the defense was going to say it. And so it wasn't like, well, we had to look into this and that, and that, because I feel like if it's not true for me, I have trouble, you know, as we all should, you know, we should only say if it's really, really conviction behind it. And I just didn't have that. So that's just one thing I can think of offhand.
Well, I've actually had lawyers object to that when I did it, and they argue it's improper vouching, because essentially the implicit message is, well, we looked into it and we concluded that was wrong. So I'm telling you, you know, I believe it's wrong. She really couldn't get up and say, right? So that, but I think that was the structure of it, that, well, we looked into it and ruled it out because it's incorrect. It's not the right result, which you wouldn't be able to say directly. So you probably shouldn't be able to leave that impression indirectly. But I agree with you. It's like Mark Mandel's thing, which I completely buy into, is the idea that you should never do anything in the courtroom that you don't feel good about.
Yeah.
I think people also pick up on that if you're not really being true to yourself and saying things you don't believe.
100%. I remember the first time I tried to do, I don't know if it was the cherry pie thing, and I just was like, this was probably like, I don't know, 8 years ago, and I was just learning it. I didn't really practice it enough, and I just totally flubbed it, and the jurors were like super confused, and the defense attorney's objecting. It's like, and the judge is like, what are you talking about, counsel? And I'm like, I don't even know, Your Honor. I apologize.
I really can't do the cherry pie without trying to do the Mitnick accent with it. Now, some people like cherry pie.
Where did this accent come from, counsel?
I actually think you're more effective in court if you have that, like, Southern accent. You know?
Oh, I know.
All
man.
The real trial lawyers have that.
Well, so we have actually, I did some of my research. And so you have a son that goes to Wake Forest, right? Yeah. So both my grandparents went there. My uncle's a professor there. But my grandfather was a Southern trial lawyer, grew up pretty poor in rural North Carolina, was able to go to school because of the GI Bill. He was a paratrooper in World War II, Battle of the Bulge stuff, and was never going to go. No one in his family ever went to college, but the GI Bill allowed him to. Went to Wake Forest for undergrad and law school, and yet he just had the best old school Southern accent. And I'm from Atlanta originally, but I've obviously totally lost it, and I just really upset by that, because it would definitely come in handy now.
I don't know, how would that go over in California though?
I think probably really well.
Rahul doesn't have any accent, do you?
I don't think so.
You could do the Indian accent if you want.
I actually cannot do the Indian accent. I do the worst Indian accent on the planet. So
I think we know some lawyers who are from like Chatsworth, and they somehow have a Southern accent when they're in court.
Yeah. Would you ever wear cowboy boots in trial?
No.
Would you wear them outside of trial?
What about a cowboy hat?
No, can't pull that off.
What's the?
They don't teach that at the Spence trial.
Bolo tie?
No. I saw my buddies try to do it, and I was like, man, I can't do this.
Yeah. I don't think I know I could not do any of those things. Would you do that, Ben?
No, it's just not me. Yeah. I wouldn't feel good about it. But I would do something silly that's different than that.
What would you do?
Leather vest, maybe?
No, you wouldn't.
I don't know what I'd do.
Do you wear a three-piece suit in trial?
Three-piece?
I would. I know. People do it.
Dale Gallipo does. We got to get him on the show to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Dale Gallipo wears a three-piece suit when he's... You know, yeah, leisure time activities, you know, hanging out with the family on Saturdays.
He's got his own great, unique style.
He definitely does. We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. Well, one thing I've noticed about LA, when I was in high school, I took a trip out to California, and one of my father's good friends lives right here, actually, in Marina Del Rey. And when I stepped off the plane, he picked us up at the airport. The first thing he says was, you can't come to Los Angeles dressed like that. And it really hit home that people out here dress totally different. It's... You know, you look around the conference, you know, people are generally well-dressed, and and wear like expensive suits like Rahul's got on there. And
online,
you know, there's a lot of youth in the legal profession out here. It's kind of a, it's like an episode of Suits. You never seen that show?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm surprised. So I lived in New York for a year, worked for a big law firm. You're in New York. You're in New York?
No, I wasn't. I did work in New York when I was younger. No, I'm in Maine now. We're just getting dressed at all is a challenge.
But Ben was saying in a prior podcast that you never wear a suit in trial, right?
I haven't for probably a decade or so. I'm thinking about going back to it now, though.
So what do you wear?
Usually just... you know, khakis and a sport coat.
No tie?
Oh, I wear a tie, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, and I wear quality, clean clothing. You know, it's like respectful for the process. It's just that in most areas in my state, I mean, a suit would be considered incredibly dressy. And even if you're in a sport coat and a tie, you're way better dressed than most people ever are. So it's fancy enough. So I've kind of liked that. I don't know. Someone made that suggestion somewhere, and I just tried it out and kind of liked it. But
I know, Raul, you have some interesting wardrobe on your first day of trial, I found out recently.
Well, yeah. So I was with Carl Douglas, and we were doing a presentation, and he was talking about his style and that he's very colorful. And then he looked at me, and he goes, or you could do the banker look, you know? So I'm definitely...
No, but I thought there was some more personal wardrobe choices.
Yes.
That I found out about recently at a conference.
Just day one of trial, Sherry Dempsey, a legal assistant at the old firm, Green Broylett, Taylor, Wheeler & Panish, back then, she gave me as a going away present a pair of black underwear that say Pootie's Booty on it. So that is what I wear every day one of trial, even though it's now... kind of almost, you know, run its course. Yeah. So
I think that moment is going to come soon or should probably. You're right. If it does, I'd like you to make the announcement here on the podcast.
It. Yeah. I may actually share a photo at that time, not with me in it.
I was going to say.
That's awesome. So for newer lawyers, people that are just starting and wanting to be trial lawyers, if you could help them steepen their learning curve, Dan, what would you recommend to them?
So first thing I would say is focus groups. So if your firm doesn't do focus groups, do everything you can to convince the partner that it's a very valuable case cause, it's good expense, and you can do it pretty cheap. We do some of ours on, you know, if a case is not multi-seven figures, we'll do our own Craigslist, pay $20 an hour, you know, you get however many people you want, do it in your conference room, have your staff do it. You can do that, you know, you do a focus group for $1,500. But I think doing that, getting on your feet as much as possible in front of strangers, you practice your voir dire, you do an opening, you do a closing. If you're not able to get in trial, obviously the number one thing is get in trial as much as possible, but that's easy to say. I think one thing you can do is as many focus groups as possible, you know, once a month. I know Claggett does once a week, I think. But I think as a young lawyer, that is the best experience you're going to get if you're not in trial, is just getting on your feet, working stuff out. I mean, because, you know, we're always learning and trying new creative stuff. But the best place to do it is focus groups. I love them. I mean, I try to do them as often as possible now. And I think I have my brand new associates get up there. And if you can't do a focus group, at our team meetings, we start to do Fridays where they just get up and we play jurors. You just get up there, you do like a half hour a week, just gets them on their feet, you know? And I think just as a young lawyer, almost insist upon it, convince your boss that this is well worth it for everyone, including him or her.
What's your firm now? How many lawyers do you have?
We have five. Yeah.
And you're right in LA somewhere?
Yeah, we just moved to Westwood, new offices, yeah.
Like last week.
Yeah, like this week.
That's amazing. Yeah.
No, it's great. We love it.
What's it like trying to build a firm in a place like LA? It just seems like from somebody from a small, out-of-the-way state coming here, it just seems like it would be such a daunting task to take that on. And, you know, where do you start? How do you get your cases? How do you make your name for yourself?
Yeah, it's daunting being in a big city, you know, small fish, big pond type deal, 100%. But it also, there's a lot of opportunity here and a lot of, you know, a great community. In LA, we have a fantastic, Cala is a fantastic organization Raul and I are part of. And people really want to help out younger lawyers, like not to get anything in return. I mean, it's just amazing how the plaintiff's bar selflessly really just wants to help younger attorneys because it's just the whole cycle. I mean, so many people have helped me. And I think as a plaintiff lawyer, you know, I know, so, especially now post COVID, so many just have with their laptops starting from home. I mean, you can do it so cheap. I remember when we started our firm, we were able to get a line of credit for like $300,000. It was three of us. And I think we had to dip into it at probably like 100 to start out. We had no savings. You know, we were all in debt, law school debt. But so it cost us about, you know, $90,000 until we started making money that we could just, you know, break even and eventually start making a profit. But I think the barrier now is so much lower because of Zoom post COVID. That you could, you know, honestly work from anywhere. And so I think, yeah, like it's a big city, you know, tons of competition, obviously, in personal injury in LA. But I think it's just very doable with our community and, you know, technology.
Set yourself apart or find cases. Do you try to like narrow your little geographic region? I mean, you're not obviously going to go on Google and be ranked number one for personal injury cases in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. You have to spend millions a month. And so, I don't.
Like in my state, our firm started a year and a half ago and we're on the first page in virtually every category on Google because it just isn't much competition, right?
Yeah.
But out here, that's totally different. Now, how do you manage that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question. I think you have to decide what kind of firm do you want to be. And we said from the very beginning, we want to be the badass trial firm. I mean, you know, a lot like Panish and Raul's firm is just, we don't want to be big volume. We're not set up that way. And I just personally don't like, we want to work every case, you know, as hard as possible, do, you know, motions to quash, motion, you know, corrective orders, like just as hard as a defense firm that's going to paper you to death. We want to be that on the plaintiff side. So we can't take on a ton, but so almost all my cases come from other lawyers, workers' comp attorneys. You know, I have a lot of great friends from law school. I think it's been huge for my firm. I mean, that's how I got most of my cases in the beginning. It still is. I mean, some of my closest friends, you know, obviously all lawyers and a lot of them do workers' comp. So there's a lot of crossover there. And, you know, younger lawyers in the organizations we're part of, Cala, I really don't like to be the one who's just like, you know, give me your case. I just never liked that when I was coming up. So I'm big on just collaboration and I'll help anyone who ever needs it and not like expect to try to get the case at all. Cause I think people need to learn to, you know, first chair their own cases. But when we do co-counsel, I'm a big believer in they get to do as much as they want to do. They can take as many witnesses as they want to at trial, whatever they want to be a part of, you know, because I, not only, even if they're, you know, newer attorneys, I learn from every one of my co-counsel every single time, every single case I do, even though they're less experienced, but they just have a different, you know, way they've been trained or the way they think of things. And I think it's just so rewarding. And honestly, almost every one of my co-counsel have become close friends and people that I did not know before. And now we're close friends and we collaborate a lot and I help them where I can. I send them stuff and I tell them, hey, look, maybe I'm not the right fit, even though I could handle that case, but I'll set them up with a friend of mine to try the case together. Cause there's plenty to go around and I love the collaboration. I think it's just the best way to learn.
It's a good answer.
Absolutely is. Yeah.
You're paying it forward. And that's part of what you do with LA Trial Lawyers Charity as well, right?
Yeah, no, it's a great, great organization started by Bruce Traney and a bunch of trial attorneys before I was even an attorney. On the plaintiff side, they didn't really see really good avenue where trial lawyers are giving back to the community. Obviously, we do, you know, what we do in the courtroom, but the insurance industry has had such powerful PR on, you know, how they label us and have done it for decades. And, you know, that's just not the truth, right? I mean, we know that. We can say it till we're blue in the face, but we know deep down that that plaintiff's attorneys truly have some of the biggest hearts of any attorney out there, truly care for their clients. And we felt there's a way to really give back. Attorneys want to give back in ways outside the courtroom. And then to show the world that we are good, caring people. And so these small group of trial lawyers, some of the top trial lawyers in LA got together formed Los Angeles Trial Lawyers Charities. And I think the first 5 years they were giving away, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Now we've given away almost $6 million to the community and do a lot of hands-on events where we'll do a day of dignity where we bring showers in, doctors in for into Venice to help the homeless population, you know, get them checked up, get them clothes, get them showered, just have a day to get back. We do Great Trike giveaway where we donate about 15 to 20 adaptive bicycles for children who can't ride just a two-wheel bicycle or have disabilities. So they're able to ride the bike with their brother or sister or their friends now because they never could before. So it's just a beautiful day where all these kids come and they have these bikes that are just custom made for them. It's just great stuff. And it's all the trial lawyers just giving back their time and their money back to the community that needs it most, especially, you know, during COVID, we did a lot. I was president last year in 2021. Steve Artisan is this year and just doing a fantastic job. And we've just grown. It's really great to see.
Yeah, that's good work.
Yeah, and if you guys want to start one in Maine, we're expanding. We just launched Orange County. We're looking to the Bay Area, and we want to go
coast to coast. You know,
coast to coast, man.
Just like a podcast.
Yeah. Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate all that you do both for the community and our friendship. So thanks so much.
No, thanks a lot, guys. This is all, I love your podcast. I mean, it's so great way to learn and hear about new attorneys that I never really knew. It's awesome. Great work, guys.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.